Welcome to Asia Calling, your window on Asia. Coming up on the show this week, we come to you from Vietnam's Mekong Delta, the food bowl that is sinking into the sea. In Afghanistan, we speak to families who are forced to travel abroad for essential medical treatment because they can't get the care they need at home. And public transport infrastructure in Pakistan is being slammed by environmentalists as trees are being razed to the ground and replaced with concrete. And finally, from Timor-Leste, the remarkable story of brave activist Bella Gallos. Thanks for tuning into the show. I'm Nicole Kirby. At the southern end of Vietnam lies the Mekong Delta. Its Vietnamese name, Cu Long, means nine dragons, referring to the nine rivers that come from six countries and meet there, ending a journey of several thousand kilometres to the sea. The Mekong Delta is the most fertile area in Vietnam, and it's also the most fragile. It's the country's rice bowl, and it's now slowly sinking into the sea. Asia Calling's Kanika Pechkau travelled to Vietnam to find out more.
Vietnam's Mekong Delta is a land carpeted in endless shades of greens. It's a water wall that moves to the rhythms of the mighty Mekong River. Boats, houses, and markets float upon innumerable tributaries, canals, and streams that crisscross the landscape like arteries. Million people call the Mekong Delta home, and 60 million rely on its river system. This folk song describes the Mekong as a lifelong partner that provides wisdom and guidance to local people. But the river system that has sustained life for so long is now taking life, and the area itself is dying.
We think Delta may disappear in the next 100 or 200 years in the future.
Leung Anh Tuan, a researcher with the Climate Change Research Institute at Kantar University, says the Mekong Delta will be completely gone in 100 to 200 years. The delta is suffering as climate change causes rising sea levels and erratic weather patterns, like frequent flooding and droughts.
In the year 2050, Vietnam is not become dry export to the world.
Leung Anh Tuan says that because the area is low and flat, it is vulnerable to salinity, erosion, and flooding. The Mekong Delta is an agricultural miracle area that pumps out more than a third of country's food crops and 60% of its shrimp and fish, while it takes up just 10% of its total land mass. So changes to the area will have catastrophic impacts for the people of Vietnam, snatching away their food supply. Tham Sao, 61, is watching her children play as she tells me that the land we are sitting on here in Minh Thong district, 4 hours' drive from Kantar, is sinking.
Look at that canal. It gets wider and deeper, and the bank gets steeper every year. We hardly use the water because the bank is about to collapse. Many houses on the bank have already been moved. People there couldn't sleep at night.
They have good reason to worry. Riverbanks are eroding all over the Mekong Delta. Just 2 hours' drive away, in Dam Doi district, more than 30 houses were swallowed by the river. In April, another disaster in Nam Khan district killed a family of four while they were sleeping. Towns and homes all over the delta are being swallowed up by the rivers.
Many of us have given up our long-time habit of living by the sea and rivers, as erosion can kill at any time.
Groundwater is being extracted at an ever-faster rate to support growing urbanization. That's causing severe erosion and the collapse of riverbanks. On the one hand, land is sinking because of erosion, while on the other hand, rising sea levels are swallowing up low-lying coastal areas. Coastal provinces are being squeezed. Each year, hundreds of acres of land disappears. Mai Wan Huang works in Trasu Natural Conservation Site in An Giang, not far from where the river just swallowed another row of houses.
We used to have an abundance of fish in the area. Since they started building dams upstream, fishermen near my village found it more difficult to fish. Fish are becoming scarce. We notice it at the dinner table.
Erosion and rising sea levels are increasing the salinity in the area, making farming impossible.
Rice crops were the first to die, followed by hardier fruit trees and coconut palms. And eventually, even my saltwater shrimp were lost.
As I leave Tom Sao's home, I see signs erected in dried up shrimp ponds, advertising land for sale. People who have lived off this land for generations are being forced out to nearby cities to try and make a living there. But it's not clear where the food will come from now the Mekong Delta is disappearing. For Asia Calling, I'm Kanika Petgap in the Mekong Delta, Vietnam.
Each year, thousands of Afghans travel to other countries for medical treatment. They're driven to places like Pakistan, India, and Turkey, spending more than $250 million each year on medical services that they can't get in Afghanistan. Gail Waziri has this story from Kabul.
Najiba Azizi is 40 years old. She has heart disease, and 2 years ago she suffered a heart attack. She has been trying to get medical treatment in Kabul for around a year with no success.
I realized that it's impossible for me to get treatment in Afghanistan, even though I have spent more than $4,000 on my treatment here.
With no other choice, Najiba now travels to Pakistan each year to receive treatment.
My family and even my doctors finally advised me to go to Pakistan.
She is not the only one traveling internationally for medical treatment. There are many others who do the same, some even making the journey without visas and passports. Najiba's son, Naveed Azizi, says that his mother's constant travel to Pakistan hasn't been easy, especially as tensions between the neighboring countries mount.
We face many problems such as abuse from Pakistani police, expensive treatment, difficulty getting visas, language barriers, and transportation problems.
But the family are just grateful that Najiba has finally received the treatment she needed.
My family and I are really happy to have my mother with us. I was worried about her recovery.
For many, traveling to another country is something they simply can't afford, leaving them without treatment. According to the World Bank, more than a third of Afghans have no access to health care. Since the fall of the Taliban 16 years ago, Afghanistan's health ministry has received millions of dollars in international donations. There have been significant improvements. But people like Najiba are still frustrated by medical standards in Afghanistan. A lot of that money has been whittled away through corruption, lining the pockets of officials.
We are trying to develop medical facilities of a good standard throughout Afghanistan, especially in Kabul.
That is Sayed Wahid Majro, spokesperson for the Afghanistan Health Ministry. In an effort to improve the low standards of medical care in the country, the Afghanistan Ministry of Health is in dialogue with the governments of India and Iran. Afghanistan is seeking money and expertise to improve medical infrastructure in a move that would strengthen its relationship with India and Iran.
We are in dialogue with India and Iran to make them ready to support us to have standard medical centers and pharmaceutical companies.
Afghanistan hopes to develop the capacity to produce its own medicines rather than relying on imports. According to the Afghanistan Ministry of Health, there are now 52 government-run hospitals and more than 360 private hospitals operating across Afghanistan. Majro says the Afghan government hopes to rely on partnership with the private sector to access technology and equipment which is desperately lacking in public hospitals.
Next year, we are aiming to have specialty medical treatment centers. In coordination with the private sector, we want to build standard hospitals in different parts of the country.
But private sector chief Bashir Sakai says that Afghanistan private sector may not have the experience required.
It's difficult to provide the best quality medical services compared with India, Pakistan, or other neighboring countries. Those countries and their governments have worked for around a century to improve medical services. Our private sector is only 16 years old. How can we compare?
Bashir says it will take many years before Afghans will be able to get standard medical treatment in their own country. Challenges like a lack of technology and expertise, insecurity, and corruption are still being overcome. In the meantime, those who can afford to travel and pay for treatment have a way out. But Najiba admits it's a difficult solution, even if you can afford it.
We face problems in Pakistan, but I recover. In Afghanistan, you can spend a lot of money, but you will get nothing.
For Aisha Kaling, this is Ghayur Waziri in Kabul, Afghanistan.
You're listening to Asia Calling KBR. Pakistan is currently experiencing its hottest summer on record as climate conditions become more severe. With air pollution 10 times higher than the safe levels recommended by the World Health Organization, it's also the fourth most polluted country in the world. The government is now spearheading public transport projects in major cities, which would normally be considered a win for sustainable development and the environment. But this time, environmentalists are slamming the project, as trees are being traded for transport. Naeem Sohotra reports from Karachi and Lahore.
Hundreds of trees are being cut down in Pakistan's southern city of Karachi, paving the way for a new bus service, ironically named the Green Line Bus Service. At an estimated cost of 16 billion rupees, or 22 million US dollars, the bus service is supposed to serve about 300,000 passengers each day, connecting residential areas to the city center. Commuters like Karamdeen say the buses will bring a welcome change.
People cannot reach their destinations on time because of frequent traffic jams. Many people who are sick face great difficulties. I hope that once this project is complete, it will benefit the public and people will be able to get where they are going.
Karachi is Pakistan's largest city. It is the country's economic lifeline and home to 20 million people. But its infrastructure lags behind other South Asian cities. Traffic jams last for hours. Buses are decades old, worn out, and leave clouds of smoke in their way. The break time in the middle of the road.
khoobsurat sa tohfa dene ke liye aaye hain aap.
In February, former Prime Minister Mian Nawaz Sharif launched the bus project, declaring it a gift to the citizens of Karachi. An efficient public transport service would normally be considered a positive step for the environment, but environmentalists are calling this project a green disaster.
It will reduce the carbon emission, but the damage done by them should also be compensated. Otherwise, it's non-sustainable development because on one hand, it benefits the people, but on the other hand, it will cause harm to the environment.
That's horticulturist Rafiul Haq. He was born and raised in Karachi. 20,000 trees will be cut down in Karachi to make room for the Green Line bus service. Rafiul Haq says that's green cover the city can't afford to lose.
Karachi used to have 6-7% urban forest cover in the past. The forest has shrunk to less than 3%.
The government promised to plant 17,000 trees to replace those lost. But Rafiul Haq says the government hasn't kept its promise.
The project has promised that the trees on the route of the Green Line bus service will be carefully uprooted and then replanted somewhere else. Few trees were replanted and they have all died because the procedures were not properly performed.
Former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's government takes pride in infrastructure projects they have led across the country. But these projects all follow a similar pattern. In 2013, the first metro bus service was launched in Lahore, once known as the City of Boulevards. 500 trees were chopped down to make way for other project. 2 years later, Islamabad lost 1,000 trees in a similar project. The government recently launched the metro train project in Lahore, but the High Court has temporarily stopped construction due to its impact on environment and heritage. Lawyer Humayun Faiz Rasool filed the public interest litigation.
This is a concrete project. Over 25.7 kilometers, there will be total concrete. And you know, it is proved in a scientific research that every kilometer of concrete will rise 2 degrees centigrade in the environment of the Lahore. And definitely, the poor people of Punjab will suffer a lot.
In recent years, Pakistan has seen a rapid change in climate patterns as winter and summer become increasingly severe. In 2015, an extreme heat wave killed at least 3,000 people in Karachi. An efficient public transport system and sustainable development is essential. But lawyer Humayun Faiz Rasool says rather than dealing with the country's long-term challenges, these infrastructure projects are destroying the environment for short-term political gains.
When the government started this project, it was just started with an intention to grab votes and sympathies. The people need good education, health and environment. I am making a categorical statement that the government of Punjab has not planted a single tree and has cut down hundreds of trees, which is a big, big loss.
For Asia Calling, this is Naeem Sohotra reporting from Karachi and Lahore.
In 1975, Timor-Leste was invaded and occupied by the Indonesian military. Bella Galos was just 3 years old. She witnessed family and friends being killed, and she was sold for just $5. Since then, Bella and her country, Timor-Leste, have fought for independence and worked towards rebuilding after a brutal occupation. Teodosio dos Reis met Bella Galos in the mountain village of Malbiser, Timor-Leste. The mountain air is cool, and I'm looking out across a whole field of strawberries. If I turn, I face a garden full of flowers. I'm here at Green School Leblora, in the village of Malbiser, 4 hours from Timor-Leste's capital, Dili. Bella Galos built this school 3 years ago, determined to make a place where a healthy community could grow.
I want to show the young men here that good work is not just done in the office, but in the garden too.
The school is dedicated to the memory of her mother.
Even though my mother has already passed away, this is how I show my appreciation of her.
Bella's mother was born here, in Malbiser village, Timor-Leste.
I chose to return to the place my mother was born for my mother's sake. When she was a teenager, she was the only girl in school.
Bella and her mother haven't had easy lives. Throughout Bella's childhood, Timor-Leste was occupied by the Indonesian military. Their rule was brutal. Massacres, rape, and extrajudicial killings swept the country. Women were sterilized, children forcibly separated from their families. When she was just a toddler, Bella's father sold her to an Indonesian military captain against the will of her mother.
When I was 3 years old, my father sold me. One of the reasons he gave for that was that he was embarrassed by me because he thought I had a dominant masculine personality.
Bella's mother desperately begged for her daughter back and eventually brought her home. But both Bella and her mother continued to experience violence at the hands of her father.
My father also had a second wife, and he was physically violent towards all of us.
Until her mother finally left. At 16, Bella became involved in the resistance, fighting for freedom from Indonesian military rule. Infiltrating the Indonesian military, she was sent to Canada. There, she defected and agitated for her country's independence. Returning home in 1999, as Timor-Leste gained independence, Bella began work as an advisor in the presidential palace. There she advocated for the rights of women and children. And even though it's difficult, Bella started to speak out about her own experience, how her life has been marked by violence from the military and her own father.
In Timor-Leste, normally women stay silent about violence they have experienced because many women don't want to bring shame on their family. I want to encourage all women to speak out about the bad things that they have experienced in family life.
Bella is one of the first women in Timor-Leste to speak openly about domestic violence. And back at the Green School in Malbiser village, she's nurturing social change. The school gives kids the chance to learn about leadership, non-violence, and the environment in a country that's still recovering from the scars of violent occupation.
Children are very important for us to teach because they are the new generation. We must teach them to love the natural environment and all of nature.
More than 400 kids, aged 7 to 12, attend the school. And Bella is encouraging her neighbours to help in the garden. While most of Timor-Leste's food is imported, here they're growing food and flowers themselves. In acknowledgement of her tireless work rebuilding her country and society, Bella has been granted the Dalai Lama's Unsung Hero Award. For Asia Calling, this story is from Teodosia dos Reis in Dili, Timor-Leste. That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced at the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about the show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter @AsiaCalling for more updates. You can now also podcast the show. Go to the iTunes store and search for Asia Calling to subscribe for free to the weekly episodes. I'm Nicole Kirby, back next week with more stories from Asia.
Trong chiều hoàng hôn, ta còn là ta. Mỗi một đường vắng một mình ta. Nắng chiều vàng.